This is the second of a 3-week series on end times. Jesus is coming again. Hallelujah. And that should be a point of rejoicing. And I'm going to suggest longing for him to come again and make things right and take us away from the horrendous circumstances that this world surrounds us with. Last week, we also saw when Jesus comes, he is going to reign on earth for 1,000 years, this millennium, in which he will reign with his church, and the enemy, Satan, will be bound, no longer able to deceive the nations. And if you want to hear all about that and the disagreement that exists between and concerning the timing of that, listen to what was said last week. Last week, we also heard about Israel, and we saw the Apostle Paul confirm that God is not finished with his people, Israel. He's not finished with them, not because they have been so faithful. He's, despite their rebellion against him, he's going to do things with the nation of Israel because of God's covenant promises, because of his love for them. And we're going to see all about that today. So today we're going to move forward and bring those two streams together. Jesus coming again and God breathing life into his people, Israel. I'm going to see what he's doing with all of that. And in order to do so, we're going to step back in time to words written of prophecy in the book of Ezekiel, 2,600 years ago, to the time when Ezekiel himself was in exile. The very first verse of the book of Ezekiel says, chapter 1, verse 1, I was among the captives by the river Kibar. He's in captivity in Babylon. You might remember that there were three waves of individuals taken out of Judah, taken into exile in Babylon. The first happened in 605 BC, and that was the year when Jerusalem was attacked, and a whole series of nobles were taken away, including Daniel and his friends, Shadrach, Meshach, Abednego. That was the first wave. In the second wave, Jerusalem was attacked again, and the treasures from the temple were taken to Babylon. And it was during that second wave that Ezekiel was one of the people taken along with them. And then came the third wave in 586 BC, when Jerusalem was conquered completely and almost everyone was taken into captivity in Babylon. So let me give you the context and how this man, Ezekiel, is writing. He's writing a message which is similar to the message that came from Jeremiah. Jeremiah, of course, is writing in Jerusalem. He's still in Jerusalem, and he has a message which first points out the cost of the sin and rebellion that has caused them to go into exile. But then he gives hope of some people coming back to Israel after a set period of time. Ezekiel gives a similar message. It's a message which in the first 24 chapters are all about announcing the judgment of sin and rebellion of this nation towards God and the price they will need to pay for that. But then he comes back with other messages. The next section, 25 to 32, are oracles to the nations around, and they're concerning judgment that is going to come to those nations because of what they have done towards God's beloved nation of Israel. And then in verses 33 to 48 of the book of Ezekiel is hope. And it's that section that we're going to be looking at specifically in the next couple of weeks. But he's looking ahead to events way in the future, events which include the restoration of Israel to its land. So let me take that final section of hope and let me unpack that a little bit. I'll work backwards. The final chapters 40 to 48, concern that time when Jesus reigns. We're talking about the millennium period. The two chapters immediately preceding that, 38 and 39, concern the events that will take place immediately before it, the war that we all have heard of, that is going to be called Armageddon. We'll look at that next week. But this week, we're looking at chapters 36 and 37, where God promises to restore his nation and to restore them to the land that he's given to them. Now, if we're going to understand the significance of the verses I'm about to read to you from the previous chapter, from chapter 36, and the wrath and anger with which God speaks concerning those who have abused this land, you need to understand what has taken place in the last 2,600 years. From 586 BC, when the people went into exile, when they paid a horrendous price, in addition to being alienated from the God with whom they no longer have a direct relationship, in addition to having no place of worship, Jerusalem, with which they can approach their God, they also have no longer a homeland to call their own. They have no government to rule them. They don't even have a common language. And we find that by the time some of the folks are coming back to the land of Israel, they've assimilated the languages around them. So at the time when Jesus was walking in this earth, in this area, he was speaking Aramaic, not Hebrew. Such is this separation of the people from God and the land that he'd given to them. For the next 2,500 years, that picture remained the same. And in that time, with no government ruling them, the land was occupied by a succession of empires. Initially, the Babylonian Empire had taken them into captivity. They were conquered by the Persian Empire, the Persians and the Medes. In turn, they were replaced by the Greek Empire. Then came the Roman Empire. The Roman Empire merged into the Byzantine Empire. And so it goes on, with other people occupying this land, including the Catholic Crusades, including the Arab-Islamic empires, right up until the First World War, just over 100 years ago, when the land was ruled by the Turks in the Ottoman Empire. 2,500 years when other nations had occupied that land. And when Britain conquered the Turks, who were allies to Germany, in 1917, towards the end of the First World War, it became a British protectorate and remained that way until 1948, when once more it became the land of Israel. And it's into that land that God now speaks at the beginning of Ezekiel 36. With all of that history, all of that abuse that has taken place, hear the forcefulness of God's words from verse 1. Son of man, prophesy to the mountains of Israel and say, mountains of Israel, hear the word of the Lord. This is what the sovereign Lord says. The enemy said of you, aha, the ancient heights have become our possession. Therefore, prophesy and say, This is what the Sovereign Lord says, because they ravaged and crushed you from every side, so that you became the possession of the rest of the nations and the object of people's malicious talk and slander. Therefore, mountains of Israel, hear the word of the Sovereign Lord. This is what the Sovereign Lord says to the mountains and hills, to the ravines and valleys, to the desolate ruins and the deserted towns that have been plundered and ridiculed by the rest of the nations around you. This is what the Sovereign Lord says. In my burning zeal, I have spoken against the rest of the nations and against Edom, for with glee and with malice in their hearts, they made my land their own possession, so that they might plunder its pasture land. Therefore prophesy concerning the land of Israel and say to the mountains and hills, to the ravines and valleys, this is what the Sovereign Lord says. I speak in my jealous wrath because you have suffered the scorn of the nations. I swear with uplifted hand that the nations around you will also suffer scorn. And so have those individual empires ever since, and will again. God says to the mountains and to the valleys of Israel as witnesses, to the land that has been ravished, to the people who've been oppressed, to all those nations that have occupied and plundered and ridiculed, in his anger and wrath, he is rebuking those nations. In Psalm 24, we read, "The earth is the Lord's and everything in it." So often we think of our homes, it's ours. We think of the land as ours. We think of property that belongs to us. The Bible says it is all belonging to the Lord. And uniquely, do you realize the nation of Israel is the only nation that has been given title deeds on loan from God as their inheritance from him? That cannot be said for any other nation on any other patch of land anywhere in the world. And yet, for 2,500 years, empire after empire took it upon themselves to reign, thinking that they had control over what belonged to God and was given to his people. So what's the land that we're talking about? There is great disagreement about this. As you can imagine, there is so much about the timing of so many other things. But let me put a map on the screen that's got very little detail in it. But you can see at the bottom of that Euphrates River over here, this is where Abram's father was called, came from, Ur of the Chaldeans. And Abram's father left on his route to Canaan, but he only got as far as Haran. He stayed there and died there. And it was from Haran that Abram was called to the land that God would show to him, to the land of Canaan over here. But God promised him in Genesis chapter 15 that he would give to his descendants a section of land. I'm going to read it to you. Genesis 15, verse 18. On that day, the Lord made a covenant with Abram and said, "To your descendants, I give this land, from the Wadi of Egypt to the great river, the Euphrates, the land of the Kenites, Kenizzites, Kadmonites, Hittites, Perizzites, Rephaites, Amorites, Canaanites, Girgashites, and Jebusites." All those nations, and God was giving to his descendants. Who is meant by his descendants? We could argue about that at some other point. But roughly, some would say this is the area that he was given. From the Wadi of Egypt, the valley where a river runs through, is that the River Nile that he's speaking of on the left-hand side of your map? Right the way across to the Euphrates River. And this is an area going down into Saudi Arabia. Some say even further into Saudi Arabia below, that God is giving to the descendants of Abram. Now, other people would argue that's not the area. It's slightly smaller than that. How would God refer to the Wadi of Egypt, referring to the Nile, and then talk about the Euphrates as a great river? Surely the Nile is far superior and bigger and so on. So others would argue that this is the sort of area that is more likely that God was giving as an inheritance. And others would say, no, again, much further down into Saudi Arabia. So we're talking about parts of Egypt, the area that we know as Israel today, Lebanon, Syria, Jordan, and then parts of Iraq going into Saudi Arabia. Hundreds of thousands of square miles. But for 2,500 years, none of that was occupied and belonged to the nation of Israel. Until around 100 years ago. And in 1914, when war broke out and Britain faced not just Germany, but its allies, including the Turks, the Ottoman Empire, Britain started to think about the future of the area then known as Palestine. And in November of 1917, the British defeated the Turks, and the Foreign Secretary, Arthur Balfour, issued the Balfour Declaration, that the British government was announcing support for the first time for a Jewish homeland of their own. These people scattered across the world will be given their own homeland. That was what Britain was proposing. And the area that was designated for them, make the map a little bit bigger, was this. That's the area that it was suggested should from now on become known as a homeland for Israel. That was 1917. A few years later, in 1922, the Hussein family, a family of Arabs who lived in that area, objected. Don't know whether you realise, but of the Arab states, they are all run by families, by kings. So the Saud family, in Saudi Arabia, the Al Khalifas in Bahrain, there's their own family running UEA in Dubai, etc. And in that region, it was the Hussein family who still rule in that country today. They objected, and so to appease them, the British government subdivided that land roughly in a line down the River Jordan. To the west, in the areas I've coloured green, that was designated as an Israeli homeland from this point on. Not all of it, the area of green. And everything to the east of that line was called Transjordan, which means across the Jordan. And in 1946, it became known as Jordan. So Israel was given around 5,500 square miles, not the hundreds of thousands that appears to have been given by God in the first instance. And you'll notice that Jerusalem is that circled area in blue in the center here. That would be regarded as an international city, and the area would be partitioned then into the green areas, which are for Israel, and the browner areas for the Arab settlements there. Jerusalem completely surrounded by Arab settlements. But in all of this, after 2,500 years, the nation of Israel was to be given its own land. Finally, they would be back in a land that God had given to them. God is faithful to his word. He said he would restore them to the land. And even after a 2,500 year gap, when you would imagine any other nation would just have been swallowed up, the nations of Israel would be established again. And that would come in 1948. And we will get to that later. Listen to what we read from verse 8. But you, mountains of Israel, will produce branches and fruit for my people Israel, for they will soon come home. I am concerned for you and will look on you with favor. You will be plowed and sown. Remember, he's speaking to the land. And I will cause many people to live on you. Yes, all of Israel. The towns will be inhabited and the ruins rebuilt. I will increase the number of people and animals living on you, and they will be fruitful and become numerous. I will settle people on you as in the past and will make you prosper more than before. And for 100 years, in fact, actually before that, when things began, it has continued to be a land. And God is working his purposes out in that place. But it is a work in progress, as you will see. Verse 27, and I will put my spirit in you and move you to follow my decrees and be careful to keep my laws. Then you will live in the land I give your ancestors. You will be my people and I will be your God. I will save you from all your uncleanness. I said, it is a work in progress. But notice something else that is really important in this. Because there has been a political agenda and there has been an idolatrous, worshipful agenda. Listen to what God says. This is really important for us to hear. Therefore, say to the Israelites, this is what the sovereign Lord says. This is verse 22. It is not for your sake, people of Israel, that I am going to do these things, but for my sake, for the sake of my holy name, which you have profaned amongst the nations where you have gone. I will show the holiness of my great name, which has been profaned among the nations, the name you have profaned among them. Then the nations will know that I am the Lord, declares the sovereign Lord, when I am proved holy through you before their eyes. And if you've not quite heard that message, this comes again and again and again. Verse 32, I want you to know that I am not doing this for your sake, declares the sovereign Lord. Be ashamed and disgraced for your conduct, people of Israel. Now, I said really clearly last week, it is important that we respect and honor. These are a people who are God's people, and they do remarkable things, as we are going to see. But do not worship them. It is really important. That is idolatry. God is doing this because he is the holy God. He is the one doing it. We worship God. And the same principle, we don't worship the buildings that we meet in. We don't worship Christian leaders. Really important how often we make this mistake. So it is about Israel. And in all of this, God will reveal himself. And for those who've got eyes, I believe he is doing this. Verse 34, the desolate land will be cultivated instead of lying desolate in the sight of all who pass through it. They will say, this land that was laid waste has become like the Garden of Eden. The cities that were lying in ruins, desolate and destroyed, are now fortified and inhabited. Then the nations around you that remain will know that I, the Lord, have rebuilt what was destroyed and have replanted what was desolate. I, the Lord, have spoken, and I will do it. And this was written 2,600 years ago. And through this tiny, what some would say was an insignificant nation, God will and is doing astonishing things, and he will reveal who he is in time as he does this. That's the role that the nation of Israel was always supposed to have, to point to God and reveal him to the nations around. It's the role that we have as the church today. To point to God, not ourselves or the church. It's a priestly role. And the remarkable story of God reinstating his homeland for the nation of Israel is just a part of the hand of God at work. And the verses that we've read speak of a desolate land becoming like the Garden of Eden. And did you notice that verse that spoke about lying desolate in the sight of all who pass through it? For a long time, that was the situation. There's a much quoted reference cited by Mark Twain, who's an American writer, who in 1967 visited the region, along with lots of other regions around there. And this is what he said about Israel specifically. This is how he described it. A desolate country whose soil is rich enough, but is given over wholly to weeds. A silent, mournful expanse, a desolation. We never saw a human being in the whole route, hardly a tree or shrub anywhere. Even the olive tree and the cactus, those fast friends of a worthless soil had almost deserted the country. So it had been laid waste by empire after empire. When it was given back to Israel, it was suggested they were going to get 70% desert. Today, people suggest that the arable land in Israel is around 17%. Israel is one of the driest countries. It's the 15th driest country, apparently, in the world. And yet, it is one of the world's leading agricultural innovators. When I was studying at university for my PhD, it was Israel that was leading the revolution with hydroponics, with drip irrigation. People spoke about things happening there that were happening nowhere else. 15th driest country in the world, and yet its exports of fruit are measured in the billions of pounds. They are ninth in the world in terms of flour production. And I had a look and I found that Israel exports more dates than any other nation on the world, and it's tiny. The hand of God at work in that nation. And Jews themselves, across the centuries, have been extraordinarily fruitful. An illustration, I'll look the facts up, I'll look the details up specifically. Do you know that from 1901 to last year, 2024, 965 Nobel Prizes have been awarded. Okay, presume you've all heard of a Nobel Prize. There's a Peace Prize, there's a prize for medicine, for science, and many other things, literature. 965. Do you know that 216 have gone to people descended from Jews? People who claim Jewish hereditary. That's 22% of all the awards that have been given, even though Jews represent not even 2% of the world's population, but 0.2%. A tiny proportion. And they've got 22% of all the Nobel Prizes. Interestingly, Christian people claiming Christianity as their faith of background, have received 65%, the biggest proportion, but there are lots more of those in the around the world. Muslims, who represent more than a quarter of the world's population, 26% by contrast, have received just 15. Giving you the numbers. When you look at what has been achieved for a nation lost for 2,500 years, scattered around the world, persecuted, butchered, like no other nation has experienced so consistently, the re-establishment of Israel and the disproportionate success of Jews, I personally struggle to see how anyone can argue that God doesn't have his hand on that nation and is not doing something amazing with the nation and the people of Israel. Which brings me to the conclusion of what happened in 1948. And only now do I get to make reference to chapter 37 that Jackie read to us, which reveals how God alone could bring life to what everyone else would describe as lifeless. What those verses even suggest as being people taken from the grave. He's speaking about the nation of Israel. The valley of dry bones, having life breathed into them, is a picture of God, what God would do with his land and people. Verse 5, this is what the sovereign Lord says to these bones: I will breathe life. I will make breath enter you, and you will come to life. I will attach tendons to you and make flesh come upon you and cover you with skin. I will put breath in you and you will come to life. Then you will know that I am the Lord. Verse 11, then he said to me, Son of man, these bones are the people of Israel. They say our bones are dried up and our hope is gone. We are cut off. Therefore, prophesy and say, this is what the sovereign Lord says, my people, I am going to open your graves and bring you up from them. I will bring you back to the land of Israel. Then you, my people, will know that I am the Lord when I open your graves and bring you up from them. I will put my spirit in you and you will live, and I will settle you in your own land. Then you will know that I, the Lord, have spoken and I have done it, declares the Lord. And this is what God has done for Israel. And I'll just put that map back onto the screen again. And in 1947, the United Nations voted to partition Western Palestine into a separate Jewish and Arab states. And on the 14th of May, 1948, David Ben-Gurion declared the existence of the State of Israel. He wasn't being arrogant. He wasn't being boastful. He was stating what God had declared was going to happen. They were given these 5,500, sorry, 5,500 square miles. It would end up like this. The following day, all the nations around attacked them. Egypt, Lebanon, Syria, Jordan, Iraq, Saudi Arabia, Yemen, and the Arab Liberation Army. Seven armies invaded that tiny area of Israel. And let me give you a measure of the hostility that they faced. The Arab League secretary said this will be a war of extermination and a momentous massacre which will be spoken of like the Mongolian massacres and the Crusades. It's not just today in social media, but garbage is spoken by people who underestimate God. The Grand Mufti of Jerusalem, who had been meeting with Hitler in 1941 and had been involved in trying to recruit for Germany Muslims during World War II, he proclaimed, "I declare a holy war. My Muslim brothers, murder the Jews, murder them all." That's what Israel faced, this fledgling nation of around 600,000 people at the time, with an army that had been scraped together of around 19,000 people. No tanks, no ships, no combat aircraft. And the might of seven armies, all equipped with the conventional arms that armies like that would have at that time, and all the hatred that drove them. Tel Aviv was shelled from the sea by the Egyptian navy. Cities were bombed. Hundreds of tanks came across the border. They faced impossible odds. And at best, the CIA gave them 6 weeks to survive as a nation. They were not supported militarily by any other country. And just 7 or so months later, when the war ended, not only had Israel taken that land, which had been designated for somebody else, they had occupied all of those regions. Extended it to 8,500 square miles. Egypt continued to occupy Gaza. Jordan occupied the West Bank, that's that central bit in the middle, and the Golan Heights were occupied by Syria, the high point overlooking Israel. And in 1967, when the next significant war took place, and the nations again attacked Israel. Israel did a preemptive strike, and at the end of the Six-Day War, they'd taken back all of those territories. It's an astonishing story. And the odds against Israel were just impossible. But 2,600 years ago, God said that he would give his nation back to the Jews. It's a story that you don't get to hear about on the local news media. And I am not giving my support and not suggesting that with everything and anything that comes out of Netanyahu's mouth, don't confuse any of those things. I am not getting us confused with the secular nation of Israel. That's a complex story, and they do not do things I am sure that God would be happy with, that Jesus would promote. But the day is coming, and God has done remarkable things in this story. But the message to us is clear. God is faithful to his word. And the odds against what he might be doing or what we might be facing are irrelevant to God. He does what he says he will do. This is the God that we have. And as we get closer and closer to that end point in time, God is continuing to work in his nation. He's not finished yet. And he's moving towards Jesus coming again. And that's what we're going to get to next week. Let's pray.